Working Cows Podcast, episode 142.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network, here with another episode for you. And I'm really excited to return once again to talk to Brian Alexander about his strip grazing experiment, about what he has learned as he has come back around to those same areas that he grazed last year. We have talked to Brian before. We're going to talk to him again today, and I will have links in the show notes page for today to all of Brian's previous episodes, so you can walk through this from the first time the cows showed up there last year to now this year, coming back to those same places and what he's learned as a result of those opportunities. And so it's good to be joined again by Brian Alexander. Really looking forward to this conversation. Brian, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Clay, it's always a pleasure to be here. It's always great to talk to you, and I can't tell you what an honor it is to be on the podcast for, what is this, number four?
That's right.
So how many four-time losers do you have on Working Cows, or am I it?
Oh, no, Dallas has still got you. I think he's five.
Okay, well, that's I'll allow Dallas.
Was he your instructor for your second time through in Texas?
Yes. Yes, he was. And I was really glad to have him, you know.
So, hired hand, is that new?
Yes. Yes. When I went to Ranching for Profit back in December last year, one of the big things that I was recommended to by my table to do was to seriously look at trying to find a hand to hire and somebody to mentor. So, that was in December, and, you know, kind of thought about it. I looked around a little bit, looked at some of the classifieds on Ranch World Ads to see what people were looking for and see what people were saying, hey, I'm here, I can do this, and looking for a job. And I didn't really see a whole lot I was excited about. So as it turns out, this young lady I met last August when I was at the Bottom Line Conference out in Lake in Kansas, I saw in January that she posted she was looking for a job. Oh, okay. Well, send me a resume. So she sent me a resume, and she ended up coming up right around the 1st of February for a day, and met my fiance and I, and came out, rode around, looked at the ranch, talked about it quite a bit, and ended up making her a job offer. And she started right at 2 months ago. So she's been here almost 2 months now.
Mm-hmm. Every day?
Yeah. Yeah, we've worked a couple days on the weekends, and you know, I've given her a couple weekdays off just as the schedule permits, but things are working out really good. Man, she's a hard worker. She's over putting posts in the dirt right now.
Well, I don't want to keep you too long, but I think it'd be interesting to see where things are at from your perspective as the grass has started to grow based on the impact last year.
Oh, man, that's, yeah. Well, we've got a lot going on this year, Clay. So last year, you had me on talking about my little strip grazing experiment I did with some Corianes. So we doubled down on that this year. Instead of taking in some custom cattle and doing that with, I went out and I bought my own. So I bought a herd of 65. Some were pairs, some were bred heifers. Bought those back at the end of March, and we've had them on strip grazing program now for a little over 6 weeks. They are right now, we're running about, I think we're about 35,000 to 37,000 pounds per acre stock density. That's come up in the last 10 days from about 25,000. And we've really managed to squeeze them about the last week to 10 days as the grass has come on. And the really cool part about those is, we've got them moving on bat latches. So she only builds fence twice a week, and we've got that herd moving every day. So I said we doubled down on that, and we really did double down. The fence that I've been building, which is why I was a little late today, We're converting 715 acres in my south cell from, you know, kind of a rotation graze situation. We're converting 715 acres more to strip grazing this year.
Sure.
And we had, oh, well, we have a herd of 200 replacement heifers that I'm growing for a good friend of mine. And we're strip grazing them. And we've got them, they're on a selective high density program. So they're about 22 to 25,000 pounds per acre. And we're trying to get them on a selective program. Now, my Corrientes, we're trying to force them to be non-selective.
Sure. And where are you, what helped you decide what the optimal density was for that, for those herds?
Oh, I don't know if I could really put my finger on any one thing. There's a lot of different things that go into a stocking rate decision or stock density decision. With my Corrientes, I'm a little less concerned with breed up. You know, the ones that breed are the ones that breed and they're going to stay, you know, and that's my problem. But on a customer basis, when I'm doing this for a customer, I've got to do everything that I possibly can to try to ensure that he's going to get as good a breed up as he's expecting. So that's why we're staying on a non-selective grazing program at relatively lower densities on a daily move, if that makes sense. I mean, 22, 25,000 pounds stock density, still pretty high, but they're leaving plenty behind is what I'm saying. So that's, we're trying to keep them non-selective, so they're not just cleaning the pasture out every day. So there's, you know, there's still some of every type of plant left that they didn't graze during the day. That to me, you know, they're still able to self-select and stay on optimum nutrition, but we're not forcing them to eat other things in the pasture.
Sure. And so this year, you would say you're doing more strip grazing than you were last year?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, last year we just had that little 250 acres fenced off for strip grazing, and this year we're adding another 715 to that. So,
sure. And the Corrientes this year are grazing on what you strip grazed last year?
Yes, sir.
Personal herd?
Yes, sir. My personal herd is grazing where I did the Corrientes last year that I custom strip grazed.
Sure.
And, you know, we've got about half as many, and that creates some interesting situations with water. I bought a temporary portable water system, whatever you call it. I've got 2,500 feet of pipe. I've got a trailer that's got solar panels, batteries on it that's attached to a submersible pump. And then I've got another trailer that's like a little, you know, it's like a 500-700 gallon tank that I can drain, pick up, pack up, and move in less than 5 minutes. So that's allowing me to move water, you know, up to a half a mile away from an existing water source. So I could put a water tank in a far corner of a pasture, and I don't have to have, you know, a 2,000-foot lane or a 2,500-foot lane going all the way back to water.
Sure.
So we're moving the water a lot closer to the forages where the cattle are going to be grazing. And, you know, when your cows don't have to walk a half a mile to water, your grazing efficiency goes up because they're spending more time with their heads down and the grass and less time walking back and forth to the water tank.
Correct. So sounds real good. Would you say that last year was above average, below average, about average as far as favorability for growing grass, let's just put it that way, in your part of the world?
Well, we grew a lot of volume. We grew a lot of volume, but the problem was there wasn't anything in it. It was real washy and real poor. I wish I would have known a little bit more about bricks and soluble sugars and been able to look at my grass a little bit different last year. But hey, you know, we're all learning new things all the time. This year, right now, we're sitting just right at 3 inches behind on moisture, which isn't great. You know, I've been driving around quite a bit last week looking at my pastures, you know, driving around looking at some of the neighbors' pastures. I don't feel bad about where we're at. I'm a little bit cautious if it doesn't start raining a little bit more. We may have to get into a destocking situation down in July. Right now, we're still living off a lot of last year's moisture, but we've got good sunshine. Had good sunshine so far, and temperatures have been good, so the grass is doing well.
And just kind of to give the strip grazing experiment that you had going last year a fair shake, do you think what percentage of what you're seeing on the ground this year do you think is a result of above average moisture? What percentage do you think is a result of the way the land was managed last year in the strip grazing paradigm? Kind of some of those ideas.
Where I strip grazed last year, the grass was probably 5 to 7 days ahead of anything else on the ranch. It greened up a little quicker. There's an extra 2 to 3 inches of leaf on a lot of the plants over there versus areas that weren't stocked as hard or grazed as hard. Density, there's no bare dirt over there. Now we had them, like I said, I got this herd in at the end of March. So I think we put them in the pasture, I believe, on the 23rd, if memory serves. It's only been in about the last 2 weeks that we've really had, an appreciable quantity of grass. Forbs came up, forbs started to come up, 3-4 weeks ago, but it's just been a really slow process greening up because it's been dry and it's been fairly cool. So they had to live on, they lived on dry grass for almost 4 weeks and did pretty well on it, put a lot of litter cover down on the ground. I mean, there's very few places I can go out there and see bare soil.
The strip grazing, you feel like left more litter that is contributing to getting started better this year? Or what do you think it is that made the difference between what was grazed in a strip grazing paradigm and what wasn't?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I could just say it's just stock density, it's herd effect. It's cows being less selective about what they eat, trying more plants, putting their spit on, the base of those plants. Your urine density is pretty high. Your manure density gets higher when you're on that high stock density program. You're concentrating all that biology in an area for a very short time, and then you leave and let nature cycle all that biology and do what it does. That's the strip grazing. I mean, having the high stock density and the high, real high herd impact and the long rest periods it's obviously working for the grass over there.
And what are you still waiting to see? Like, what are some of the things you're keeping your eye on as far as that whole method of management is concerned and deciding how you're going to address year after year these different opportunities you have?
Well, I'll be honest with you. Last year, I was a little bit aggressive with my strip grazing. And seeing how things are waking up this year and how things are starting this year, I was a little aggressive. Without getting too much into the weeds, I'm just going to try some different stuff this year and not graze something that hard twice in a year again and see what it does grazing it a little bit harder, but once a year, see what that looks like.
So kind of define what you mean by strip grazing. I guess this is like the fourth time we've talked, and every time we've talked about strip grazing, I'm not sure we've ever defined how you're using that term. How is that land being impacted? What are you looking to leave behind when they leave? Some of those things.
Okay, so what I call strip grazing, we're moving the cattle every day to a fresh paddock. And, for 65 head, right now we're on about a 1.3 to 1.4 acre paddock. And that's a pretty non-selective graze for the forage that we have right now for them. And what we're trying to accomplish is you want to impact every plant. Have that plant be bitten, stepped on, laid on, peed on, or pooped on. And we're getting, I think we're right on that. We're leaving very little edible material behind. You can go out there and everything just flat on the ground. When you have manure pats that are dropped where one of them had already laid down for a period of time flat in the grass, then you have a manure pat dropped on that, and then you have something come by and step in the middle of that manure pat, that's a lot of energy being put on to that little piece of dirt. And then you get off of it for several months and let that piece of dirt do its thing. Let that piece of dirt cycle that biology and turn that biology into more topsoil.
Are you guys doing any dormant season grazing? Do you have any cows there year-round other than the Coriannies you've brought in March?
I did not keep anything over the winter. Everything was off the place. I think 2 days after Christmas is when we walked the last of the heifers out. And then we didn't have anything on the ranch until the 22nd of March.
Sure.
So, did get a couple months off where I didn't have to get up and chop ice every day. But that's obviously going to change because I'm not going to sell my herd every fall and buy them back again every spring. That'd be pretty silly unless the market's really, really fun. But that's not the plan. The plan is to keep the ones that I have and hold on to them. I kind of have a long-term vision of where I want to go, and this is just the first step in that vision.
Would you say that you see the place being under the whole place being managed through strip grazing in the future, or is there going to be kind of places where you do it 1 year and then something else the next?
I've been wrestling with that a lot lately, Clay. The ranch is, 7,000 acres. So from one end to the other and one side to the other, things can change. Terrain is drastically different. Where I'm doing all my strip grazing is down on the south end of the ranch, where things are relatively, they're not as severe as the north part of the ranch, where you've got a lot of big hills and steep canyons to navigate. The south end of the ranch is not like that. It's pretty flat and it's more up on top and it's pretty easy to get around and it's a lot easier to fence. So what I'm saying is, this whole, the south part of the ranch I call the south part or the south cell, it's barely a third of the entire ranch. And terrain's a big issue out here. Water's an issue out here. Would I like to convert more of the ranch to strip grazing? I'm not sure about that yet. I'm thinking maybe most of the south part of the ranch will be strip graze and that'll be summer range. And then, some of the stuff on the north side of the highway that's not as developed and not as subdivided, that'll be more of a winter range to where we don't have to worry about where we're not out here every day moving fences when it's really cold.
How are you managing coming back to a place that you were last year so that you're not necessarily hitting the same paddock at the same time year after year?
Well, I'm not doing the fencing. So she doesn't know what I did last year, and I just said, well, go graze it. I'll help you move the water. You figure it out. And she's done an excellent job of figuring out, okay, well, let's put the water here, and I'll run this way and this way and this way and this way first. So last year, obviously fences aren't, we're not putting fences back in the same place where they were last year. So that's a little bit different. The cable backbone's still in the same place. So we still have these, major subdivisions of the 60 to 90 acres to play with. I think I have like 16 reels now with polywire on them. It's just absolutely absurd. We've got 10 bat latches. I kind of committed to this, and we're going to move two herds. We're going to strip graze two herds, and they're going to move every day, but we only want to build fence twice a week.
And how is that working out for you so far?
The Coriannies move themselves. Tomorrow morning, they probably won't because we're going to show them something a little bit new. But as long as you stay consistent with the bat latches, they seem to work really well. We had the Coriannies, they were just clicking along. It was about 20 moves in a row that they'd done by themselves. And they'd been moving north to south through the gate. Well, then we switched and we had them move south to north. And it took 2 days for them to kind of figure that out and get back used to it. So then we did 10 days of them moving north. Well, then we ran out of real estate and they had to go somewhere else. So then we started, the strips were laid out north-south. So they were moving west to east through the gates. And they were confused. They didn't know what to do. And we kind of had to retrain them a little bit and, show them the gate 3-4 times. And they figured it out and they went on and moved themselves. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, every time you change something a little bit, you know, going from on those bat latches, there is a slight retraining period. The other group of cattle, my custom heifers that are on bat latches, let's see, they came today's day 8 with them, and they moved themselves yesterday and they moved themselves today. And it was the first two times that they moved themselves. Every other time we've had to go show them where the gate was and lead them through with a siren. So how long does it take to train them to bat latch? A week to 2 weeks.
And do you feel like that has been a very good solution from managing the rest of the ranch standpoint?
I think it's excellent. You know, people say, oh, the bat latches are expensive. Yeah, they are expensive. But, if somebody says they're too expensive, they don't understand, you know, what a device like that can do for you. So, and we just had a little bit be meeting this morning about this, talking about Brix levels and when we want to move. Currently we're moving, I think we're set up to move at either 7:45 or 8 o'clock right now is when the gates are timed to open. So tomorrow is fence day. And when she starts setting up fences for tomorrow, we're going to go ahead and stay on the morning schedule until Monday. And Monday's the next fence day. And on Monday, she's going to go build half paddocks, go build one half paddock for each herd, and then go back to full paddocks. And we're going to go from moving at 8 o'clock in the morning to moving at 2 o'clock.
To take advantage of a higher Brix level in the afternoon?
Yes. Yes. But 100%, I think that going to that afternoon move is going to be beneficial across the board.
So, and I guess you kind of answered it, but my question about the bat latches is more from a quality of life standpoint or helping you up the quality of management across the rest of the ranch that isn't being managed under the same regime or paradigm. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, and it's flexibility, Clay. It's flexibility in your schedule, okay? So if you know the cow's got to move every day, you know, buy the bat latches. You'll build three or four ahead of time. That way, if something comes up tomorrow morning, you know, your kid gets sick or you have to take your cat to the hospital or, you know, it's just raining and you don't want to get out of the house. Well, your fence is already up and your gate's going to open on time.
And they've been performing well. The technology is doing well. Maybe we should talk about what a bat latch is for those who haven't been exposed to that.
A bat latch, it's kind of hard to explain it, but it's a little box with a screen on it and six buttons. And when you get it in the box, you're like, I paid how much money for this? I could build one of these, but you really can't. And you can set them up for multiple events. You can set it up to, you know, to cycle several times. I don't understand how to make that work. I can understand how to make it drop a gate when I want it to. I get that. So, I buy my stuff from Jacob Miller, Livewire LLC. Great guy. I'm probably already put a bunch of money in his daughter's college fund. That's okay. Jake's a great guy, and you know he's doing a lot for the community. And he's one of those guys. He's not just selling it. He uses it every day, and as he's using it, he's coming up with ideas to make it, you know, make better tools and make things better.
Yep.
And I really appreciate that.
Yep. When you call him and talk to him about something and you ask him, you don't ask what do you know has been done. You ask him, what are you doing? And he's,
yeah,
yep, this is what I'm using. This is how I'm using it. So good stuff.
So he sets them up, you know, he sends a spring gate. He puts a bell on it.
Hmm.
And he also changes out the white plastic handle for a nice Thammer handle,
mm-hmm.
which I appreciate. And we even went a step further than that. I, you know, stole a page out of Bert Teichert's book and he said, hey, tie some flagging tape or something shiny on all of your gates that you're getting ready to move through so the cows can see it. And then when it's not there, they see something's totally different and they know where they're supposed to go.
Hmm.
So I think combination of flagging tape and the bell making noise, I think those, you know, I started with that and on the bat latches, and I think that's working a lot better. So the bat latch, it comes with a strap and you can, I mean, we've done it tied to a plastic T post, a metal T post, or just a creosote line post or a metal post. Just, I mean, it's a strap, tie it on, mm-hmm. whatever. and then you hook your spring gate to that and you make sure you have it stretched out. So then when your timer, when the bat latch activates, when it reaches the set time, there's a mechanism that rotates and it releases the metal part of the zammer handle, and the spring retracts and the handle flies across the other side of the gate. The bell goes nuts and makes a bunch of noise. So if the cattle are standing right by it, I got cool video of this happening. I think it was Monday morning. They're standing right by it. They're watching it, wait for it to go. The bell goes, three of them that were standing right there freak out, run backwards about two steps, and then they turn around and they run through the gate. And they run through the gate about three steps and they put their heads down and they start working. And the rest of them just piled in there in 10 seconds. It's pretty cool to watch.
And so is that's down then and it stays down? You would have to go back out and put it up if you wanted a back fence?
We're back fencing every third day, or, you know, every third or fourth day. So when she goes out to take up, you know, the previous several days of fences that are dead, that they could be back grazing, but they're not, she rolls those up and she brings a back fence up and makes a back fence lane.
And they're not grazing back because of the fouling effect and because what they're on is better than what they left behind and some of those things?
Right. Now, I haven't seen my Corianas doing hardly any back grazing, maybe one or two are, you know, off back grazing. And what they had a couple days ago, that might just be because they're a little bit dumber than the rest and couldn't figure out how to get through the gate. Not real sure on that. Some of my custom heifers, though, it's strange. They do some back grazing, but then again, you know, I'll see them, I'll drive by, and there'll be half of them out back grazing. And then 10 minutes later, I'm coming back the other way, and they're all where they're supposed to be laying down. I'm not too concerned about it. You know, we're going to limit any back grazing to less than 5 days.
Right. And so the Burke Tigert talked about some flagging on the gate. Is that put up when the gate is installed so that they can see it coming, or is it installed somewhere in the intervening days after the week's worth of grazing is set up?
We put those up. I mean, we just maintain them up on all the bat latches, you know, when the flagging gets torn up or anything. She just goes ahead and ties another piece on. But on my non-strip grazing cattle, which, you know, there's only three herds of cattle on the ranch that aren't strip grazing, we do the same thing on all the gates for them. You know, we go around, you know, before we move into that paddock or pasture, you know, when we go around and check the fences, the gates we're going to use to move out of that paddock, we put flagging tape on. Flagging tape is really cheap, and if you're going by it anyway, it takes 30 seconds to tie two pieces on a fence. Sure. Is that worth it? Is that worth it for helping them move? Absolutely. I think it's definitely worth it. They don't come up to the gate in bulk.
Right.
They don't come up and stop and look for the wire anymore, you know, because they're looking for the flagging tape, and if they see that off to the side, they know it's okay.
Yep. So are you calving? Are they calving right now at your Corianis?
Yeah, we've had three in the last 4 days.
And how's that going under the strip grazing regime of management?
Well, they're Corianas. I mean, they don't need help. It's going real good. You know, people may get concerned. You know, they drive by and the cows are all standing on like 1.4 acres and they're just in this, you know, line that's, you know, 50 feet wide. And then there's calves scattered all out over the, you know, everywhere. I got one neighbor. He says, "Oh, those calves got to find their mamas." I'm pretty sure that they can get back under that wire and go find their mom real fast. You know, if you want to see find her mom, turn your dog out and you'll have a bunch of upset mothers with their calves underneath of them real fast. As far as we've seen, everything's paired. Everything's got their calf and, you know, the calves stay reasonably close. I don't think it's a problem.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think that a lot of people that I've talked to that do even some rotational grazing that are calving through rotational grazing, they'll just open the gate up and give them 24 hours kind of to get through and come back and get their calves, and then they close the gate behind them. So would you say that's kind of similar to how it's working for you? Those cows might go through, but they'll come back and get their calves and bring them through?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They know where they left their calf. They know absolutely where they left that calf. They'll come find it. And, you know, the fence, my electric fences aren't calf-proof.
Right.
You know, they're cow-proof. They're not calf-proof. Did that for a reason. You know, they can walk under one. There's almost always a couple high points in every fence that a calf can just duck right under, no problem. And we do that on purpose, just so that, you know, the calves, if they want to get away from their mothers, they can get away from their mothers and go do their own thing, seek some higher quality forages, and they can still get back with their moms when they need to.
Some creep feed.
Sure. Natural pasture creep feed, I guess.
That's right. So last year's aftermath, or last year's stockpile, is nature's calving barn, and the stuff that's the best, that's ahead of the herd, is nature's creep feed.
That's right. And that's, you know, that's kind of where those calves stay. They stay, you know, like, they stay a little bit ahead of where the cows are, or, you know, they're where the cows are going to be in a month, right across the cable. But, you know, they're out there, and they're always standing in what looks to be really, really green, good looking stuff when they're not with the herd. And that doesn't bother me at all.
So when is calving season at the Alexander Ranch for the Coriani herd?
Oh, if the sale barn vet is to be believed, I'm probably still going to be having calves in July. but I don't mind. And here's the crazy thing. I'm going to turn out bulls probably at the end of June, because I want to be calving like now.
Right.
You know, I want to start calving probably the last week of April, so I'll probably turn out bulls the last week of June.
Sure. And
you know, you want to, what's everybody say? I mean, what are they teaching ranching for profit? What are they, you know, what's Bert Tykert always say? What's Greg Judy say? All these guys are telling you, calve on green grass. You need to be calving on your green grass. There, a lot of guys around here calve in February and March. There ain't anything green in February and March.
Right.
You know, there's even guys that calve in January. It makes a lot of sense that you want to calve on green grass. Most nutritious, highest, you know, most nutritious, highest protein grass, you know, because that's when your cow is going to need the most requirements. Right after she has that calf, she's trying to put weight back on. She's trying to put fat back on so she can make milk, and she's trying to stay in good condition. Makes sense that you want to do that on your best grass.
Sounds good. You can tell me what you want to say to this question, and this question can disappear into the ether if you want it to. But do you have time and the desire to talk about what's going on in the markets right now in the livestock industry?
Oh, goodness. Now, we could talk about it for 2 hours, but by the time you air this episode, it'll be old news.
Well, this will be out in the middle of May. It won't be that old.
Okay. You know, so we're probably, you know, 10 days to 2 weeks out from this airing, and things may be completely different. The speed that things have happened in the last 60 days with the coronavirus pandemic, the speed that things have happened is just blown my mind. Like, absolutely blown my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Of how fast things develop and how fast things are changing and how fast, you know, how fast information goes from being fresh news to literally everybody in the world knowing it. You know, it's like an 18-hour cycle, it seems like, almost. So, you know, markets, obviously the markets are fraudulent. You know, after the Tyson fire last fall, this coronavirus pandemic, the cattle market is fraudulent. And it's being exposed for some of the fraud is being exposed for what it is. And I can only hope that there's some action taking place. And I don't know what that looks like to remedy the situation. And again, I don't know what that looks like either. One of the solutions in my mind is we need more localized slaughterhouses. We need smaller, more localized slaughterhouses all around. You know, you're in Belfouche, South Dakota. How far do you have to drive to go to a USDA inspected facility?
30 miles for a small one, but other than that, quite a ways.
And right now, how far out are they to get a kill date?
Six months. Can you even
get one this year? 6 months.
Yep.
And that's pretty similar around here. Everybody's 6 to 9 months out for a kill date. And it's ridiculous. So, you know, we have 50 meat packing plants that pack 98% of the beef cattle. Just 50 plants out of like almost 900 USDA plants in this country. 50 of them handle 98% of the cattle. So even, you know, like we saw with the Tyson fire. Okay, they shut that plant down for a couple weeks. Yeah, there was extra capacity in the system. You know, slaughter number never went down. But, I mean, we sure got paid a little bit less, and they sure charged a little bit more for box beef price. Now the capacity's all there. The demand is all there. They just can't get it through the plant, and that's the problem. Too many people working in too small of an area, and really what it comes down to is, you know, that kind of centralization with the meat packing, we're taking a lot of that money out of our local communities that should be staying in our local communities. You know, if we had smaller local processors that would pay ranchers a fair price for the cattle that they raise, slaughter that meat, feed your local communities, and then export the rest, you know, to places like New York City and Chicago and LA, you know, we need to focus on feeding our communities first, because the cattle you grow and the cattle I grow, when they leave the ranch, you know, if we don't have that animal processed ourselves, when it leaves the ranch, we have no idea where it goes. When somebody goes to our local store to buy a steak, they have no idea whether or not they're buying from a local locker, a local rancher, or from, you know, some feedlot operator in Colorado. There's no way to know. And if we can change just the labeling rules, so people know where that meat came from. People know that came off an American rancher. People know that came from a Brazilian feedlot. And we got to differentiate our product.
So your Facebook profile picture has at least one time said, I am libertarian, right?
Still does.
Yep. And I have some of those same sympathies. So how do we balance that from a free market approach and a country of origin labeling approach, or do you have something else in mind?
Well, the libertarian in me just wants to scream, let's just disband the USDA and be done with it and let the free market take over.
Yes.
We both know that's not going to happen. I think the next best thing right now, today, is the Prime Act. Congressman Massey from Kentucky wrote the Prime Act over 2 years ago. There's a matching bill in the Senate, and it's all locked up in committee. I don't know what anybody else has been doing about it, but I found out about that over the weekend, and today's Thursday. Mm-hmm. I missed it yesterday, so Monday, Tuesday, and today, I've called my Congress critter and my senator and yelled at him. Three times each. And I'm going to keep calling them every day until they start looking into the Packers and until there's some action on the Prime Act.
Sure.
And I'd recommend everybody in America do the same thing.
Yep. So workingcows.net/142 is the show notes page for today. And it's going to be a rich one. We'll have links to Brian's social media profiles at Red Hills Rancher. We'll have links to Tomcat Manufacturing and their portable water systems. We'll have links to the Bat Latches. We'll have links to Livewire LLC, where you can get Bat Latches and other great fencing supplies. We will have links to some articles that Brian and I both found helpful and have shared on Massey's Prime Act and on Temple Grandin talking about the fragility that exists when you have such a large scale packing facility that is no longer able to process meat. So workingcows.net/142 is the place to go for all of that. And I guess, are there anything we left on the table that you were hoping we would cover today from a strip grazing standpoint? Anything else you want to say from a market standpoint that you haven't got to get off your chest?
No. But do you want to talk about Pasture Map?
How about this? Tell me about any of your indispensable tools that are helping you manage at a higher level.
Well, as usual, Pasture Map is a really excellent tool, and it's even shown a lot more of its value this year since I've hired Meg. You know, I've spent a lot of time on Pasture Map. You know, of course, all my pastures are on there. My gates are on there. All my water tanks are on there, the water caps. I mean, everything you can imagine you want to know about your ranch, it's in Pasture Map, and everything has a name. the first, oh, I guess about the first month she was here, one of the first things we did is I got her set up on pasture map. So she has a map of the whole ranch on her phone with the boundaries. And it's got a little orange dot, so she knows where she's at. So now, you know, the first 2 weeks, I just sent her around with fence supplies on a four-wheeler and said, get lost and go fix fence. Use pasture map to find your way around. And she did, and she knows her way around, you know, fairly well for being on the place for 2 months. But I can just tell her, go close gate 17, make sure highway gate's closed, and then check tank 23. I don't need to explain to her where any of that crap is. She ain't gonna find it. All she's got to do is remember what, you know, what I told her to go check, and she can find it on the map and then see how to get there. So that really made the orientation and onboarding process pretty simple as far as getting around. I mean, you know, if she got stuck the other day in the creek, and I'm at home. I was already at home. I left her some tasks, and she called me and said, hey, I'm stuck in a creek. I'm like, okay, where are you at? And she told me exactly where she was, because she knew exactly where she was on the map, and I knew exactly where to go find her. Easy.
Perfect.
Having your whole team on the same page and speaking the same language and knowing where everything is, ooh, that's worth a lot. And I can assign moves on our herds that aren't strip grazing. I can sit in my office and I can assign moves to her and have program plan moves, and it'll send her a notification. Hey, don't forget to move these cows this morning. Hmm. So what's that worth to you?
Improving quality of life, improving level of management. It's kind of a lot of what we want to accomplish through the Working Cows podcast.
I'm all about it. You know, I'm all about free time with my family and doing the best job that I can for the environment and for the soil and for the cattle.
Cool. Speaking of family, congratulations on your recent engagement.
Thanks. I think she wants to get married sometime in 2021.
So. Uh-huh. Perfect.
It'll be a minute. We've only been together 10 years. I mean, why rush?
Brian, thanks for your time today.
Clay, it's always a pleasure to visit, sir. And thanks for inviting me back on your podcast. And I hope the listeners are getting something out of it.
I've had lots of people tell me they're some of their favorite episodes. So,
ooh, well, I don't know what to say to that.
Well, have a good day.
Thank you, sir. Enjoy the rest of yours.
Well, I'm not exactly sure where we're headed next week on the Working Cows podcast. Got a couple of potential leads that we might be able to realize as a guest. But again, I want to remind you, as I did on the bonus episode that came out this weekend, workingcows.net/141 if you want to listen to that. I'm trying to foster some engagement. I'd like to hear back from you. I'd like to have you call and leave a voicemail at 605-549-5401 and tell me what you have done to change your business so that it's more in sync with nature. How are you making sure that you're generating economic value so that you're not just the lowest cost producer? And then finally, what are some of the indispensable tools in your toolbox as a ranch manager, as a manager of land, animals, people, economics, and finance? Again, we'll see you again real soon with another episode of the Working Cows podcast, and I look forward to hearing from you guys at 605-549-5401. We'll talk to you soon.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.